Okay, so that's the face. Let's move next to your feet. Maybe you've had pain in your heels when you first put your bare feet on the floor first thing in the morning. If so, it could be the beginnings of a common condition. It's known as plantar fasciitis. The problem could point to your shoes. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports on the kinds of shoes that contribute to this problem and exercises that can help prevent it.
Elizabeth Kenkel has never had heel pain or heard much about plantar fasciitis. She's a 24-year-old architect living in Washington, and this time of year she likes to walk to work in her flip-flops, which she was happily doing the other day when we approached her, along with a foot doctor named Steve Pribbett, who's not a fan of flip-flops.
They're pretty comfortable, keep your feet cool, so it's nice.
And do you wear them all day long, or you just sort of wear them when you're commuting?
I just wear them walking back and forth to work and then put on the heels once I get into the office. So
I noticed a Band-Aid on that foot. Is that from a heel?
Yeah, it actually is from, well, they're actually really cute wedge sandals, but they kind of dig in because they're new.
Kneeling down for a quick examination, Pribbett explains that both of Elizabeth's workday shoe choices, the flip-flops and the backless sandals, pose the same potential problem that could lead to plantar fasciitis. He says when your heel does not stay attached to your shoe, there's a lot of extra motion in the foot.
Wearing an open back shoe, when the heel lifts off the ground, there's a lot of tension that develops in the plantar fascia, and it increases the angle that the whole foot makes with the ground, and the toes bend up further, and that just stretches the plantar fascia more.
The plantar fascia is a band of connective tissue in the foot, similar in texture to a ligament. It runs all the way from the heel up through the ball of the foot, and strands wrap around each toe. It's vulnerable to injury, especially as we age, but your choice in shoes can make a difference. To prevent injury, people don't have to toss out flip-flops or high heels entirely, but when you're walking a lot, presumably on hard sidewalks, Dr. Pribbett says it's better to wear shoes with some support. Back at his office, he picks up a pair of ASICS jogging shoes that he says are ideal. They're lightweight, don't have too much heavy cushion, and most importantly, they do not bend in the middle.
When I take this shoe and press it down, it bends just at the ball of the foot where the toes attach to the foot. That's right where the shoe should bend.
When shoes have too much bend in the middle, Pribbett says it puts tension on the plantar fascia. One of the biggest offenders among fashionable shoes today is the ballet slipper, or very thin flats. Out on the street outside Pribbett's office, we see lots of women wearing them. Dominique Arvanitas says she likes them because they're comfy.
I walk around a lot, so the flats are good for me.
Perhaps compared to heels, but Pribbett says swapping them out for Crocs or sandals with a little support and a strap around the back would be a big improvement.
The ballet slippers scare me just about as much as the flip-flops do.
If you're now wondering whether there are any fashionable dress shoes that may actually be good for your feet, it might be time to ask a different question. That is, what can you do to strengthen or stretch your feet when you're not wearing shoes? That's where foot doctor Colleen Schwartz comes in. She's merged podiatry with Pilates for a more preventive approach.
We ask a lot of our feet. There are so many bones. There are 26 bones, there are 33 joints and 100 muscles and ligaments and tendons. And in order to give them the attention they deserve, spending a little bit of time every day can be so beneficial.
A little time means just 3 or 4 minutes of stretching and toning. And Schwartz says the best time to do it is first thing in the morning. Before even getting out of bed, she starts with an Achilles tendon stretch. Here's how you do it. You take a towel or a strap and grab each end. You wrap the middle of it behind the ball of your foot and then stretch your foot towards your shin by pulling the towel.
Getting an increased plantar fascia stretch at the same time is drawing the toes even further up.
Meaning flexing the toes as much as possible. The idea behind this stretch is that the fibers of the Achilles tendon go all the way to the heel, so there's a strong connection between a limber Achilles and a healthy plantar fascia. Schwartz says all the foot exercises she does at home, she does barefoot. It's also fun to go barefoot on the beach or in the grass, but when she goes about her daily life outside home, she does advocate shoes, as does podiatrist Steve Pribbett.
I think barefoot is good for some things. Shoes are good for others.
Pribbett says the barefoot movement may be gaining a little attention for its novelty. And the idea that thousands of years ago, shoeless civilizations had healthier feet could be true. But Pribbett says back then, the average life expectancy was about 30. And cavewomen didn't have to contend with glass, nails, hard concrete, or fashion. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Hey.
shoulders, knees and toes, and eyes and ears.
And that's your health on this Thursday morning. Allison walks you through a slideshow of stretches to keep your feet strong at NPR.org.
Head, shoulders, knees and toes, head. Shoulders, knees and toes, and eyes and ears and mouth and nose.
Our conversations this week about email may mystify some of the people who use it. That's because we've stressed that email is not necessarily private. Your most embarrassing work email especially could get swept up in some lawsuit or investigation. That warning could seem a little out of date to people who encrypt sensitive emails. For years now, they've essentially been sending their messages in code, and they wonder why other people don't do the same. NPR's Martin Costi reports from Seattle.
Just how vulnerable is email? I brought my laptop to this Seattle Internet Cafe to find out. As soon as I connected to the local Wi-Fi, two guys off in the corner with their own laptops started grabbing my emails out of midair.
This is a copy of an email that you received here. Introducing baby Nora, here's the email address, sent the email, Rebecca, here's the kid's name and when it was born, etc., etc.
That's Eric Johansson. He's in the computer security business. He doesn't seem to like the word hacker, but suffice it to say that Eric spells his first name with a 3. His colleague, Marcus Hodges, shows me more of the information that they've intercepted.
It was downloading your address book, and I happen to be catching part of that.
So you got part of my address book.
Yeah,
oh, that's nice.
It's people like this, people who understand computers, who often use encryption. Hodges guesses that he encrypts about 5% of his emails.
Anytime I'm sending something that I care about that identifies me as a person or I just don't want other people reading, absolutely I do it.
But you don't need some kind of obscure hacker's tool to encrypt your email. Hodges uses a free plugin that goes with his email program. There are plenty of encryption systems out there. You can find a few of them listed on our website, npr.org. Most are versions of something called public key encryption. To learn how to use public keys, I placed an internet call to Phil Zimmerman. Hello?
Hello, hello.
Hi. Zimmerman is one of the godfathers of email encryption. He even rates a passing mention in the Da Vinci Code, for whatever that's worth. In the early 1990s, he released something called PGP, encryption software for the masses. I give it a try while we're talking online. I write Zimmerman an email and then encrypt it using his public key. It's a code that he can give to anybody who asks for it. Now, as this wends its way to Menlo Park, if some devious hacker grabbed this en route, what would he see?
He would see a seemingly random set of characters.
When Zimmerman gets the email, he decrypts it using the other part of that code, the private key.
It's like having two keys to your front door. One of them unlocks the door and the other one locks the door.
It wasn't always a given that email encryption would be so readily available. In the 1990s, the feds investigated Zimmerman for making uncrackable, easy-to-use encryption available to foreigners. But these days, public key encryption programs are freely available all over the internet. Even the Microsoft Outlook on your computer has a corporate form of encryption built right in. And yet, hardly anybody ever encrypts personal email. Zimmerman finds this disappointing.
If nobody does anything about it, then we'll slowly lose our privacy. We are losing our privacy.
Some experts say encryption hasn't caught on because there isn't a single standard. Others blame Microsoft for making the Outlook version so hard to figure out. But there may be a simpler explanation. Behind her laptop at yet another internet cafe, Angela Patino says email privacy just doesn't matter that much.
I mean, it's weird thinking that somebody can look at your private stuff, but it doesn't really bother me that much.
And at the ThinkPad at the next table, Kevin Drexel goes even further. He says he tries to live a life that's fit for public scrutiny, and that includes his email.
I've kind of made being a public person just a personal policy. It's just a rule for living, is live in a way that you wouldn't mind if it was all public information.
Compare that attitude to the outrage our parents would have felt at the idea of someone steaming open their letters. It would seem that instead of changing email by encrypting it, we've allowed email to change us. Martin Costi, NPR News, Seattle.
And we'll continue our series tomorrow with a look at Email-Free Fridays.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. If you're looking for a new car that'll save money on gas, you'll probably compare the miles per gallon the different models get. And you might be making a fundamental mathematical error. That's what a couple of researchers found when they asked people to rate the gas savings they could get from different cars. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
At Duke University in North Carolina, Richard Larrick studies how people decide what to buy. He says his best guinea pig is himself. Recently, his two-car family was trying to decide how to save money on gas. Should they replace their gas-guzzling minivan with a slightly more efficient station wagon, or should they dump their fairly thrifty sedan and replace it with a super-efficient hybrid?
The improvement on the minivan to a station wagon just didn't look very impressive. It was like 18 miles per gallon up to 28 miles per gallon.
Just a 10-mile-per-gallon improvement.
And when we compared replacing a sedan, which was getting about 30 miles per gallon, with a hybrid that was very efficient that got 50 miles per gallon, that looked very impressive.
A whole 20-mile-per-gallon improvement. So, dump the sedan and get the hybrid, right? Wrong.
When we did the math and realized we drive both cars about the same distance, we realized that 18 to 28 ends up saving twice as much gas as the 30 to 50 improvement.
How could that be? Well, Larrick calls it the miles per gallon illusion. It turns out that not every increase in miles per gallon saves the same amount of gas. In fact, if you trade in a 15-mile-per-gallon car for a 20-mile-per-gallon car, you'll save much more gas than if you go from a 35-mile-per-gallon car to a 40-mile-per-gallon car. That's because gas guzzlers use so much more gas per mile. So even a 5-mile-per-gallon improvement in a gas guzzler means a lot less gas used for every journey. If a car gets more miles per gallon in the first place, the gas savings from the same improvement are less.
And we worry that people have a kind of why bother reaction when they look at cars that get 12 MPGs and think about raising it to 15 MPGs. That doesn't look big enough, but it saves a lot of gas.
In fact, Larrick conducted two surveys asking people to make car comparisons. And sure enough, most of them chose a car with the biggest improvement in miles per gallon, not the one that actually saved the most gas. Larrick says if America wants to use less gas, the priority should be get the most inefficient cars off the road right away, not try to get everyone to buy a super-efficient hybrid. Larrick published his findings in the journal Science. A lot of the confusion would disappear, he says, if the U.S. did what the rest of the world does, that is, compare cars by how many gallons per mile they use. Larrick's car buying decision then makes sense. Going from his minivan to a station wagon would save him 3.6 gallons of gas every 100 miles. Replacing the sedan with the hybrid would save only about half that.
I think it's useful reporting this fuel economy in gallons per mile, which I agree makes more sense.
David Green is an energy analyst at the Federal Department of Energy.
Especially when one is comparing vehicles for the kinds of things you want to do today, which is save money or reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Green says the government actually calculates gallons per mile when it sets fuel efficiency standards for American cars. He says consumers can do that too at a website, www.fueleconomy.gov. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. And here's an idea for trying to pry your kid away from the iPod or the Hannah Montana video or the Webkinz. How about going outside and trying to find birds? And that's a proposal from Bill Thompson, who's here with us today at Huntley Meadows Park in Virginia. Bill has written the Young Birder's Guide to Birds of Eastern North America. Hey, Bill.
Hi, Melissa.
And I brought a young birder with me today, my daughter Chloe. Chloe, who's almost six. Hi, Chloe.
Hi.
And we are here to try to see what we can see. And this is a beautiful spot we're in right now, Bill. We're on a wooden bridge over some marshland, and we're hearing all sorts of birds all around us. Bill, what are we hearing right here?
Well, there's a northern cardinal, male northern cardinal, singing right next to us here.
And what's that call?
He's kind of doing a teeter, 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 teeter. And then there's a red-winged blackbird here singing.
That sort of bray, bray.
Right, conkeree. And some Canada geese way over on the other side of the marsh.
Making a racket.
Yeah, honking, and then we've had a common yellowthroat singing just along the boardwalk here.
Common yellowthroat sounds like what?
Witchetty, witchetty, witchetty. Although down south, they're a little bit slower. Witchetty, witchetty, witchetty. That's
true.
Bit
of a southern accent.
That's true. Let me get the scope here.
Okay, I'll wait.
Set. Chloe, come here and see if this scope is the right height for you. I may need to go a little lower. See a bird in there?
Yeah.
What color is it?
Black and red.
Where's the red?
Like on its wings.
Right, you know what that is? It's a male red-winged blackbird. Oh, you just sang it. Goes, conkeree.
Did you hear that?
You'll be able to see him when he sings. Watch. You saw him sing?
I saw him open his mouth.
That's when he's singing. Conkeree.
How hard a sell, Bill, is it for you to convince your kids' friends that birding might be fun, isn't totally uncool? How to pry them out of the house?
Well, it's the first thing is just to get them out of the house. And it's not hard once you've got birds to look at to spark a kid's imagination. Because, you know, birds have these qualities that we as humans completely admire. They're beautifully colored in many cases. They make amazing noises. And they can do something that we've only been able to do in the last 100 years, which is fly. And, of course, the thing we did in the book to get the kids' attention was these wow facts.
So the wow fact on every page is in a circle. It's a big red word that says, wow, exclamation point. And this is like the fun fact, the cool thing about that bird. Chloe, we were just talking about the wow facts in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a wow fact in this book that you really like?
Yes, turkey vultures.
What about the turkey vultures? What do they do?
Turkey vultures puke on an intruder.
They do?
Yes.
And then what happens?
When they are mad and you cannot get the smell out.
Really? Ever?
Yeah.
You can wash your clothes and you can soak them in vinegar. It will not get the smell out. You may as well just burn them.
So we're walking on a boardwalk through the marsh here. Trails on all sides.
Got a lot of cattails here, a lot of jewel weed down in the cattails. And there's some mallards on the back side of the pond there. This little slough.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, let's put the scope on those mallards. Chloe might like to see those. Hey Chloe, do you want to see these mallards over here? Okay, let's put the scope on them. Okay? Step right through here. All right, let me tell me what you see right here, Chloe.
Okay. Oh yeah.
What do you see now?
Two mallards.
And describe them. What are the field marks?
They kind of like have a turquoise head and a yellow beak, and they have black on their tails.
That's right.
And white behind their black.
Got a big bird flying overhead.
Oh yeah. And you hear all the red wings doing that whistle call? That's a warning. That's a warning call. And this is a raptor. It's a hawk. I believe it's a young red-shouldered hawk. So they're warning everybody else. Hey, there's a hawk.
All right, let's move up and see if we can find some more birds.
Are there any egrets around here?
There really should be some egrets here. I don't know where they are right now.
What's that?
You know what that bird is? That's a phoebe. That's the bird that we named our daughter Phoebe after.
Back on that
branch? Dead snag to the right of the wood duck box. I'm going to put the scope on it. We'll see if we can see the Phoebe.
I got him. He's gray.
You see it? Okay. Let me put it down.
It looks kind of light brown, clay colored.
Yep. And do you see it flicking its tail at all?
Yeah.
That's what phoebes do. That's one of the ways you can tell them apart from other flycatchers is that they flick their tail.
That's kind of a plain little bird.
It is. It's a drab little bird, but you know they're one of the first insect-eating birds that you start seeing in the spring. So it's a real happy bird, and they're really energetic. They're always flicking their tail and singing, you know, Phoebe!
Do you worry about kids losing touch with nature and not getting outside so much?
I do, and we all have our attention spans just cut down to a fraction. And it's harder and harder to find time to do anything that takes time. I think the concern is that with all the stuff that gets pushed at us every day, you know, and cell phones and iPods and the internet, I mean, is that we're just, our brains are filling up and we don't get that relaxing release that nature gives us. After all, we're animals just like anything else, and this is our natural habitat. You know, our natural habitat isn't sitting in a cubicle.
And then the trick is, how do you get a kid who's used to fast action everything to slow down and wait for what might be a long time before something shows up that's interesting?
That's true, but one thing we've done with our son Liam, who's not really much of a bird watcher yet, he's 8, he leads the trip. We say, Liam, you're the scout, you chart the path, and tell us what you see. He loves that, because then he's got a job to do, and he can self-pilot.
Mm. Put him in charge.
Yeah. Well, they're in charge anyway.
It would help any kid to have a pair of binoculars. How much would that set them back?
Well, there are really good binoculars now that are good for kids, and you need to have binoculars that are right for small hands, and the eyepieces need to go close enough together for a young person's eyes. About $100. And, you know, binoculars and a starter field guide, a really good way to go. And what I found really works well is to have the kid do as Chloe's done now, write down the birds when they see them and the date and maybe the place. And then they've always got that book of memories for years to come. I've still got my book that I started in 1969.
Really?
With my, you know, little scrawly handwriting there about the first birds that I saw.
Huh.
And I love going back and looking at that.
Well, Bill Thompson, this has been a fun day of birding. Thanks for coming out.
It's been a pleasure, Melissa. And Chloe, thanks for coming out birding with me today.
You're welcome.
Bill Thompson, the author of The Young Birder's Guide to Birds of Eastern North America.
And at npr.org, you can find tips on identifying birds from Bill Thompson's Young Birder's Guide. Thompson is also the husband of our commentator, Julie Sikafoos. This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. Coming up in your health today, protecting your feet. If they hurt, we'll see it on your face. And the expression on somebody's face can tell a lot. If that person is bored, afraid, disgusted, happy, in pain. We go now to a story on how humans developed expressions in the first place. Michel Trudeau tells us about a new study that explores this from the journal Nature Neuroscience.
Faces are what neuroscientists Adam Anderson and Joshua Susskind from the University of Toronto love to look at and think about and analyze. Here's Adam Anderson.
We were interested in exploring why facial expressions appear the way they do.
Why do people around the world in every culture ever studied have very similar facial expressions? Well, one reason was already well known.
Facial expressions are critical for social communication.
Lots of research has shown that a look can speak volumes between two people. But how did facial expressions get started originally, and why? Why do they look the way they do?
Why do people smile when they're happy? Why do they wrinkle their nose and raise their upper lip when they're disgusted? Why do they raise their eyebrows and lift their eyelids when they're afraid? Why these specific muscle actions?
They had a clue, a theory from a book published over 100 years ago by Charles Darwin. He suggested back in 1872 that facial expressions evolved so a person could quickly figure out what's going on, could read the environment, to be ready to take action. In other words, Darwin hypothesized making faces probably had some survival advantage.
So he laid out some principles that really were inspirational to our work.
To test Darwin's survival theory, the researchers persuaded some university students to come into their lab and ask them to make two different facial expressions, fear and disgust. Fear and disgust faces are polar opposite expressions. So first the students made a fearful expression, and the researchers measured all facial details.
During fear expressions, one's visual field increases in size.
Meaning one's peripheral vision improved.
And we measured the speed of eye movements.
And found?
Those muscle actions enhanced or sped up your capacity to move to targets in your visual field.
And they measured nostril size and inhalation.
Fear expressions enhance your capacity to take in air, both its velocity and the volume you can take in.
So a fear expression opens up, speeds up, and increases sensory information about the environment. In contrast, an expression of disgust, a scrunched up face, does just the opposite. Disgust shuts out sensory information, the researchers found. You see and smell less.
It makes perfect sense once someone points it out to you.
But nobody'd ever studied it before, says Elizabeth Phelps, a neuroscientist at NYU. That's what's so wonderful about this study, finding a second reason besides social communication for facial expressions. They can save your life.
You're afraid of something. It may be kind of like, what's going on? What am I supposed to do here? So you want to take in more information to figure out how to react appropriately. So that's one function of what fear does to help survival.
So the next time you grimace or glare or scare, get thee to a mirror and see what Darwin saw, and now these modern researchers too. Your facial expressions are there to serve and protect. For NPR News, I'm Michelle Trudeau.
On Monday, Hilary Lister launched a solo sail around the British Isles. She expects it'll take her 3 to 4 months to cover the 1,600 miles. Lister is 36 years old and a quadriplegic. She has a progressive neurological disease called reflex sympathetic dystrophy and is only able to move her head, eyes, and mouth. She spoke with me yesterday from Brighton, England, on a break day and described the sip and puff system that allows her to sail.
The boat's controlled by 3 straws, essentially. I have one that works the tiller, so you puff to go to port and sip to go to starboard, that's left or right. And then another straw controls both sails together. And then I have a third straw, which is kind of a magic straw. It allows me to choose between 5 or 6 different functions. And I can do things like change the size of the sail. It's a cool system.
What happens, obviously, when the boat is tipping, you're unable to keep your balance on your own. How does your seat work?
Well, a friend of mine designed this incredible seat so that I stay upright and I don't fall out. I did have a moment on the first day where I had a bit of an accident with my auto systems. I really thought I was going in the water, but the seat did its job and held on to me till I'd figured it out.
There's a crew in a boat that's sailing along with you. How close is that boat?
I like them to be as far away as possible, which is about between a quarter and half a mile. They like to be quite a lot closer, just for safety's sake.
What do you do for food and drink when you're out there?
Drink I can pretty much sort out myself. Food, I have to get somebody on board the boat, and then I boot them off again.
And going to the bathroom?
No option. You don't go to the bathroom. It's that simple.
You just have to wait.
You just have to wait, yeah.
Your illness, I gather, keeps you in pretty constant pain. How much is that magnified when you're sailing and doing this kind of work?
It's actually hugely reduced when I'm on the water.
Really?
The motion of the boat is the only sort of motion I feel that isn't painful. I'm so kind of occupied with the sailing that it transcends the pain a bit.
I've read, Hilary, that at one point with your illness that you considered euthanasia, you considered an overdose of morphine, and that sailing was the thing that pulled you out of that.
Yeah, it was, absolutely. I'd been quadriplegic for about 5.5 years, I guess. And before then, I'd been really active. Even as a paraplegic, I'd been very active. And I couldn't cope with just sitting at home doing nothing, waiting to die. Then a friend just came in one day and said, would you like to go sailing? I know these guys called Westbury Sailing Opportunities. They'll put you on the water. And I thought, well, I haven't been out of the house in 3 months, so it's got to be worth a go. And the following Thursday, there I was, sitting in a boat on a lake, and within about 30 seconds, I knew that I'd found what I was going to do with the rest of my life.
Was there one moment in these last couple of days of sailing, Hilary, that was particularly exciting or beautiful?
Well, I had my first night sailing experience, and I think that's something that no sailor ever forgets, really. The moon was full, and the sky was clear, and the lights from Eastbourne were twinkling. Oh, it was just stunningly beautiful. There was almost no wind, so I could just sit back and enjoy it.
Can you even imagine how you might feel at the end?
Ready for the next challenge, I think.
What would it be?
Well, the Atlantic's kind of calling.
Well, Hilary Lister, enjoy the sail. Sounds like a great adventure.
Thank you very much. It will be a huge adventure, I'm sure.
Hilary Lister hopes to complete her sail around the British Isles by September.